Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. And the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, I want to mention our monthly guidebook slash workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your musical life and career on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from My Music Masterclass, and if you want to learn more, go to mymusicmasterclass.com, hit subscribe in the header menu, and you'll be good to go. All right, everyone. Jake is not here for this one, so it's just me and this amazing guest, Corey Weeds, who I've known for a while. And Corey's a great tenor player, and he also has a great business sense, and he's done a lot of things we're going to get into. He had a jazz club for many, many years, which was super hip, and a lot of amazing players went there. I know George Coleman and Lewis Hayes, and the list goes on. Hazeltine, Ian Hendrickson Smith, all those guys. And besides that, he started a record label. We'll get into all this, so I don't want to say too much, and he does more. Anyway, how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm living the dream over here.
Hey, yeah, we're all just hanging in. Just hanging in. Different times. It's different times.
Yeah, man. You know, we have a lot to talk about with that, because I know that you probably have a different perspective as just a performing musician because you do so many things. But how has COVID affected the label, which is your number one thing that you're doing at this point? And wait, did you rebrand? Are you now Seller Music Group or something? Or
so
you're not Seller Live anymore?
No, so what we did was we rebranded, and one of the reasons we did that, I actually kind of tried to lose the Seller name altogether with the exception of Seller Live. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening when I closed my club in 2014, obviously the name just sort of stayed, and then I kept doing stuff and I needed a name. And so the long and short of it is the Seller was so synonymous with Corey Weeds. It's like, why would you get rid of that name? Just change it. So what we did is we rebranded the Seller Music Group. And for live recordings, we call them Seller Live. And for studio recordings, they come out under Seller Music.
Okay.
So, and then that way it allows me to put all of the stuff that I do kind of under this one umbrella. But from a record label standpoint, Seller Live is Seller Live, and Seller Music is studio recordings.
Okay. Are these live recordings? I know that obviously they used to be at the club, right? So now where do they take place, or are they just kind of all over the place?
Yeah, so they can take place all over. I mean, essentially, when I close the Seller, sometimes I can be a bit of a pessimist. Like, I assume like that the world would just end and I would be driving for Amazon. Not that that's not a very respectable profession, but I just assumed it would all go away and I would be doing something like that. I mean, that might be a little dramatic, but so I didn't really think about it continuing. And so what ended up happening was, the complete opposite happened, which, I should have known, because that's usually what happens when I have this really pessimistic outlook on something. The complete opposite happens and everything's cool. But, I started going to, I kept up my New York with Weeds tour, which is another thing that I do.
Yeah, I've read about that. And we can talk about that because that's super cool. It's basically you're like a jazz tour group, right?
It's a tour group. So we started doing live recordings like in New York for that audience. And so those were live recordings. Then we would do stuff in Vancouver at, I can't think of where we did one at the moment. But then I got hooked up with Frankie's Jazz Club, which is a great club here in Vancouver. First, it was through Coastal Jazz, who produces the jazz festival. We had a parting of the ways, and Frankie's hired me directly. So we haven't done a ton of released recordings from Frankie's. We've recorded a bunch of stuff. I released one a couple years ago with Harold Mayburn and Terrell Stafford.
Sure.
But so, you know, live, it can happen anywhere. It's just if it's live, we release it under Cellar Live. If it's studio, we call it Cellar Music. And, you know.
So in terms of booking, and this goes for, you know, with the Cellar or Frankie's or whatever you're doing, from a musician perspective, like, what should they be giving you if they don't know you already? Or is it the kind of thing where they just have to get to know you? Is there a way
you mean in terms of getting a gig?
Yeah, in terms of getting a gig.
I mean, the honest truth about it is I do the honest truth. I'll tell you the honest truth. The honest truth is I don't need anybody to call me. I could book the call. I didn't need anybody to call me when I was booking the Cellar for a couple of reasons.
But
one, I have enough.
Right.
Yes. One, I have enough to draw on. Secondly, I know exactly what I want. Mm-hmm. However, I do have a responsibility as the booker of a main jazz club in a big city to be open and to take solicitations. So, you know, when I get asked this question, when I do these things at colleges, universities, you know, we in this day and age, we don't have long concentration levels. Like, we can't concentrate very long. We don't have a lot of time. So when you make a pitch, make it quickly. Grab my attention. Don't waste time telling me about your life story, unless your life story really, really is an important part of what shapes your music.
Right. Like you were the son of John Coltrane, for instance.
Yes. Or, you know, I remember I got approached by, and I wish I could remember his name, but somebody who was autistic, who suffered from autism. And so his whole story was, and it was like, okay, that's different.
Yeah,
I don't
deep.
Need to
yeah.
hear that, you know, I picked up the clarinet when I was 7 right. and then at 9 I got an out. Like, I don't have time. Usually right. it's like, I don't have time for this. I've moved on. So, you know, I would say make your pitch quite concisely, you know, make it concise and make it count. But the biggest thing is, especially if you live in the town, like if people in Vancouver are calling me, I need to see you at the club. I need to see you hanging out. I need to see you interacting with other musicians. And that to me is a really big indicator of somebody that's serious and really wants to get onto the scene. I mean, and the same goes for like I didn't start visiting New York until 2002. Like, I didn't walk right. to Smalls or Smoke or, you know, and I had an in. Like, I had people that I knew. I didn't immediately start asking people for gigs. I went to all these clubs. I introduced myself. I said hello. I started talking to people, you know. So it's not, you don't just, hey, I want a gig. Like, we all want gigs, but what's going to be different about you than you know, than the billion other people that are calling for gigs? And somebody that I see, and I can think of a couple people here in town that are going to get gigs the second they ask me, because I see them at Frankie's all the time. They're hanging out. They're trying to get involved in the scene rather than, it's not all about the gig. You know, the gig is only going to pay $100. It's not going to pay your rent. So it's got to be about a bigger purpose, you know, a longer term purpose other than just the one gig. You know? So that's what I always tell people. Like, why haven't I seen you? Like, who, you know, why are you asking me for a gig and you've never even been here? You know, you've never even checked the place out, you know, that kind of stuff. So.
And that, I mean, I, you're preaching to the choir for me, but I think this is great stuff for everyone to hear. Now, the other thing is, like, let's talk pre-COVID. I know you have a couple kids and a wife, and you're still hanging at Frankie's. It's not just when you play, right? You go there when you book as well?
It's a little different now because, right. you know, so I was let go or laid off, you know, and I had a much different role back then. I was sort of the ambassador of the club pre-COVID. So I was there a lot. The answer to your question, I was there a lot. Now I'm never there. The only time I go is if I want to go and check out the music or if I'm playing. And I'm not paid to be there. I'm not paid to MC. I'm not paid to shake hands. So pre-COVID, I was there a lot.
Right.
I would say probably at least two, three times a week.
Right. Yeah. So if someone sends you an email, and again, these are things that I've talked to people about, because when I license music, it's very similar when you're cold calling a music supervisor or anyone in terms of music in a production. The first thing I always say is that you want to talk about them and exactly what they need. For instance, I am so-and-so. I know that you work on the show so-and-so, and I know that you usually play this type of music, and I happen to have that exact type of music. And here is a link, and then the link goes to the exact two songs or one song, and then, you know, if you're interested, like right away that makes someone say, well, shit, they did the research. You know what I mean? Like, it's yeah. Kind of, you know what I mean?
This is huge, because this is another thing, and I say it exactly the way you just said it. Why are you calling me when you haven't spent 3 seconds researching? So, for example,
it's infuriating.
Like, one thing it's infuriating. Like, my band's going to be in town on Monday. We're hoping we could maybe get a gig on Monday night. Well, if you went to the website, you see that we present music from Wednesday to Sunday.
Right.
Hey, so we heard so many great things about Frankie's. We're like a folk, kind of folksy kind of rock group. Oh, like, have you been to the site and see it's called Frankie's Jazz Club?
Right.
I don't want those people to not contact me, but they could reframe it and say, hey, we're in town. We have a Monday night. We see that you're not open that night. However, we have a really big following. We've got a ton of family. We think we could probably pack the club on a Monday night. Right. Would you consider it?
Right. And also,
then my ears are,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Basically, they can even say that we're not a jazz group. I know you do jazz, but like, I figured you weren't open. You could make, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Away, you know, so they've done their homework. Right.
Yes. But the non-homework stuff, you know, kills me. And then the other one is when they send you an email and they've included all their music and my computer, like, basically bursts into flame.
Oh, you mean they attach it?
It's yeah. Like, you know, this kind of stuff makes me crazy, because there's no excuse for it anymore. It's so easy to do in an easy way.
Yeah.
You know, so it just, you got to take the time.
I was doing that stuff in the 2000s, pitching to music soups, and you never just send a CD, you know what I mean? Like, and back then it was harder. Like, I had to make my own site and then embed, you know, a player and do all that stuff. Now you can just, like, do SoundCloud, you can do this, you can do, I mean, there's a million sites you can embed music.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, on the flip side of that, you know, one thing that happens to me a lot, which I find quite funny, is that, you know, I'm a straight ahead guy. Mm-hmm. So I'm either doing, you know, usually I'm very rarely playing my own music because I'm not a composer, you know, and Frankie's is kind of like a feature. It's not a background gig where you're just calling standards. So, like, I'm doing the music of Hank Mobley or the music of Art Blakey, or it's all, I always kind of have some theme. And the reason I do that is because I like to do that. But what happens is people will call me or they'll email me and say, oh, hey, you know, I'd love to get a gig. I was thinking, you know, maybe it'd be cool if I did the music of this guy or the music of that guy. And it seems like you like that kind of thing. I'm like, if you want to do that, do it. But don't feel like it's going to sell me. I mean, sometimes it does, but you shouldn't default to what I want. Like, as a musician, the advice I'm trying to give you is, as a musician, be convicted in what you do and what you're strong for. Don't cater to what you think I might want.
That's
or come out and ask me. Say, like, you seem to do a lot of tributes. I'm like, well, you know what? I love tributes. I love doing specific albums. It's a bonus that happens to be a marketing hook that people really latch onto. But that's not why I do it. I do it because I love it. And it gives me something as a musician to get excited about and work for. But don't change your whole vibe just because you think that's what I want.
Right. And to be honest, that's a good opening, right? I mean, like, if someone actually emailed you and in the first line said, hey, you know, I'm a fan of yours. I've seen you do the tribute to Hank Mobley. I've seen this. Like, I am interested in getting a gig. Is that something that you like? You know what I mean? Right away, you're like, oh, this person actually knows who I am. Of course, I'm going to answer the email. I mean, who knows where it's going to go, but I'm going to reply.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I kept all the. I should have, if I was smart, I would have kept the emails in a folder and the phone calls in a folder that I could draw upon later just to say, look at this person who did this.
Right.
You know, I don't get a lot of those anymore. you know, because the club is fairly established and I'm fairly established, and, you know, but I do feel a responsibility to, especially with young musicians, to entertain. Like, you know, I'm quite impressed sometimes. I'm a little put off, but, you know, put off and impressed at the gall of some of these young musicians, you know, who haven't had to work as hard as probably you and I did, like pre-internet. And
for sure,
you know, like I would have never, ever dreamt of going up to the clubs that my heroes were playing at and say, can I have a gig? Like, it just never would have happened. But it's a totally different landscape now, you know? So yeah. there was a very clear sort of hierarchy when I was young in Vancouver about how things worked, you know? And that's not how they work today. And no. So sometimes I'm like, whoa, man, you need to just stand down a little bit. You're not quite ready yet. Like, yeah. you're not quite ready yet. And the fact is Frankie's in this case, like, that's the big time in Vancouver, and you're not there yet. You
right.
know, you need to be still doing the pass the hat gigs on Commercial Drive or, you know, whatever gigs are out there like that. You're not ready for this.
And thing. There's no shame in that. That's just growing
process. No, absolutely yeah. not. Yes.
So. And yeah, no, I'm with you. And the fact is that I get those emails too for my music masterclass. And I think a lot of the times it's this shotgun approach, the shotgun like buckshot approach of like,
yes.
you know, yeah. they just email everyone this template and see who bites. But that is yeah. That never works. So starting from your young tenor career, you were playing a lot in Vancouver. And why did you start a jazz club? And what was the purpose of the time? And, you know, what do you feel you got out of that experience? I mean, it was
yeah, I mean, there were, so the Coles Notes version would be that, you know, so I went to, I started pretty late in music in terms of like high school and stuff. I went to Capilano University here in Vancouver. Then I got a scholarship to go to the University of North Texas. And that's where I really kind of started to roll and be like, wow, okay,
yeah, that's a great school.
I want to do this. Didn't stay there for various different reasons. Came home, realized very quickly I didn't want to be a teacher and didn't want to get my education degree. And I went on the road with kind of like a pop sort of jam band kind of scene. Toured Canada, toured in the States, went to Europe, and, you know, loved it. And really got exposed to a lot of different music. But what was happening around that time for me is I was sort of, there was this entrepreneurial itch that I had. And this band I played in, it was kind of a, it was like a jam band, but we would actually play some jazz clubs and some smaller rooms. And I really kind of got into it. I liked it. But all while this was going on, I was a really big fan of, I hadn't ventured into New York yet. I was just a Canadian guy. So like Toronto was like the big deal, you know, coming from Vancouver. So I would go search out all the Toronto musicians and all the Toronto clubs. And I was just, you know, I was just loving it. And I would get back to Vancouver and there would be no place to go hear the people that I sort of grew up listening to. Like guys like, you know, names that won't mean anything to you, but Ross Taggart and Oliver Gannon, like the kind of the stalwart Vancouver guys.
Where was Seamus from?
Seamus was, I mean, he's been in New York longer than he ever was in Vancouver, right. But he had left at that point. Yeah. He's a few years older than me, I think. Right. So, you know, so I kind of thought that maybe I had what it took. And, man, I didn't give a shit. I was 20. I mean, I started thinking about it when I was 23, 24. And
right.
Who cares? Like, I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to have kids. I'm never going to buy a house. No woman's ever going to take me seriously. Like, I'm just going to live the jazz dream, you know? So I asked my dad to. So I played at the Cellar under the previous ownership. And I said to him that night, if you ever want to sell the club, here's my card. He's like, I'm never going to sell it. All right, whatever. So about a year later, I was picking up my girlfriend at the time. And I was reading through the local, you know, like the Village Voice of Vancouver. And I was looking through the classifieds and for sale, West Coast, West Side Jazz Club for sale. I was like, oh my God, this is it. It's the Cellar. It's for sale. So very quickly, I called my mom and my dad was like, no, I'm not lending you money to buy a jazz club. You know nothing about the industry, like just no. But my mom was like, that's your boy and you need to support him, and if this is what he wants to do, as long as he's going to pay it back, you know, let's do it. So like within the course of 24 hours somehow my mom had changed his mind and he lent me $60,000, and that was all co-signed money. and I had this partner, and I bought the club. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that happened in between there, but you know, essentially, I bought the club. We opened in 2000. I was completely clueless.
Right.
But I didn't care. I was like, if I go out of business in a year, I'll owe my dad 70 grand and I'm 26 years old. So whatever, I'll figure it out. I'll pay him back. It'll be fine.
Right.
And you know, one thing led to another thing that led to another thing. We ended up finding investors and I people really, what I was doing really resonated with people because I didn't start a nightclub. I had no interest in that part of the business. I didn't want to run a seedy nightclub. I wanted to run, I didn't want to run a restaurant because I don't like food service, but I had to based on the licensing. I wanted to run a really classy jazz club. I wanted to run what I thought the Village Vanguard would be like, even though I had never been there. That's what I wanted. And so that's what I did. And because of that, I drew people to me, investors and people who understood that, wow, there's this young punk who's really like, you know, he's mature and he really knows what he wants to do. And we want to help him. So I ended up having five investors. We never made any money. But I was surrounded by people who supported the music and we did a lot of incredible stuff there. We put on a lot of incredible shows. We recorded a lot of incredible records there and it was 14 years. And I got to bring all my friends and I got to play and what, you know, the question you were asking, what I got out of it. I mean, you know, when I bought the club, I had made the decision in my mind that I was going to put, and when I say I had a career, I mean, you know, I was doing $100 gigs and, you know, it wasn't exactly a burgeoning musical career, but, you know, I had done some stuff. I had just assumed I was going to become this club owner that would sit in every once in a while and sound okay, but I was really dedicated to club owning. And what happened was the complete reverse of that. I didn't want anything to do with the day-to-day of being a club owner. I wanted to play. I was getting to hear this music up close every single day. Yeah,
with super all of my friends cats,
sitting in and then I started bringing all these guys and they would ask me to sit in and I was just surrounded by this music. And it really switched, it really turned a corner when I brought Lonnie Smith, Dr. Lonnie Smith came. And did a weekend and we ended up recording it live and then we ended up doing a couple of tours and that's when it really started to turn a corner in terms of like, oh, my career here, if I play it correctly, is gonna go like this. And that's exactly what happened. And from then on, you know, I hired a manager and I ended up eventually hiring Jenny Larisee, who is Ian Hamilton Smith's wife now.
Yeah, I just saw her.
She ran the club and I was there a lot and it was my life, but I was more concerned about nurturing the musical side of me, which benefited the club. So, you know, I mean, you mentioned the guys, George Coleman, Joey DeFrancesco, David Hazeltine, One For All, Eric Alexander, Jeff Hamilton, like the list goes, Christian McBride, Kenny Garrett, the list goes on and on of people that I brought. And a lot of those people, you know, I forged friendships with, like Lewis Nash and Joey D and Big George and Hazeltine, Michael Dawn, all those guys. So, I mean, man, it was an incredible run. It came at a cost back then. There was a lot of stressful nights financially and just running a club in general was very difficult. And it got to a point where our lease was up and I wasn't having fun anymore to the point where I didn't like the music. I could always justify the stress because it was always about the music. And as soon as I stopped enjoying the music, and I remember when it happened, I leaned over to my wife. We were in bed one night. I got home. It was a highly stressful night, but the music was great. And like, she's like, well, how was the music? I said, I don't care. I'm done. I don't even hear the music anymore. The music is a pain in the ass. Everything was just a pain in the ass. I was like, wow. It's time to get out. So I had the option of trying to sell, although it's really hard to sell a business when you don't have a lease because we were going month to month at that point.
Oh.
And I didn't know what I was going to do after. We had changed the club to my namesake. So it was Corey Weeds' Cellar Jazz Club. So I'm not going to sell that. It just didn't make any sense. So I had an investor who had a lot of money who said, I'll take care of you. I'll make sure you get out unscathed. So I think in the end, it cost me about 20 grand just to walk away. And it was great. I never look back. I don't have one single regret. There are certain things that I miss. For sure, the hangs were epic. But, I have absolutely no regrets, and I'm better off for it, and I'm busier now. I mean, pre-COVID, busier than I had ever been in my life, and making more money and playing more and doing more. So I felt very blessed. I'm very lucky.
Yeah, man. And, I hear the fantasy all the time from musicians saying, I want to open a bar or a club. And my wife was also, her father was French from Cannes, and he had a restaurant in Philly, and he was just a restaurant guy, like he'd been a chef since he was like 12. Yeah. So my wife knew what it was like to open a restaurant or any kind of thing, and it's basically, that is your life. Like, as soon as you start doing that, like, you can just say goodbye to your vacation every year or this or that, because you have to hire great people and they're hard to find, and little things come up like insurance for this or something like this, or the distributors, so like you had to learn all this on the job. It must've been kind of a shock, but I bet as a young kid at 23, you were probably just so psyched that it was easier maybe.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, right at the beginning, I had a partner. He didn't come in financially, and he was a restaurateur, and that partnership fell apart very quickly.
Oh, okay.
The one downfall I had is that as soon as a chef came in, and I ended up having some pretty good chefs, but they're worse than musicians. I mean, food service people are worse than musicians. I can deal with musicians any day of the week, but food service people were very difficult. They weren't dedicated. It didn't pay very much, so why would they be dedicated?
Right.
But they knew right away that I didn't know what I was talking about. And so I was very lucky. There was not a lot of theft because of that, but there was a lot of, weeds. There's nobody he's doing about what he's doing. So food costs out. He's not going to know.
Oh, I see.
I started to try later on to get it figured out, but it was too difficult. And like you said, the toughness of it is that even when you're really good at it and it's your life, it's really hard to make money. The margins are still very low. And
totally.
I didn't love it. It wasn't my life. So we did what we could to get by. But it took years off my life at the time because it was very stressful. And we did what we could. And yet, you have to remember when you're bringing people, like, I often think about Spike and Smalls. Now, Spike doesn't have a kitchen, so it's a little bit different. But if you go to Smalls, on any given night, I mean, the average age there is 25.
They're in that area.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas at the Cellar and at Frankie's, we're charging 35 and 40 bucks sometimes to get in. And the people that can afford to pay that, they want a steak on the menu. They want salmon on the menu. They don't want pizza and fries and burgers. Like, they don't want fat cat. They want
what Smoke's offering.
Sophisticated,
too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I really struggled with that, because if we could have just been a burgers and fries joint,
I know,
that would have been no problem.
Chicken fingers, so, just make it easy.
Yeah, just make it easy. Yeah. But our clientele was not going to do that, and they would be willing to pay. And it's one thing to have them willing to, they're not going to be willing to pay $40 to come and hear Kenny Barron if the food is terrible.
Yeah.
So it was a catch 22, but we made our way through it. The thing that I was happiest about when it closed is I closed it on my own terms. I didn't go out of business. I made the decision, and then we strategically figured out a way to get out, the least amount of damage done. But man, there were some good times there. And those good times have continued here through Frankie's. It's much different. I don't have the ownership. Sometimes I miss my name being up on the marquee, because that's a pretty cool thing, to see Corey Weed, the Cellar Jazz Club. But I'm out of the restaurant side, and I just, I get to do the easy part. And,
Sometimes I think that's better. It's the grass is always greener. I mean, of course, I have my own business, and it's great not to have a boss, but whatever. I'm not even going to get into it, but there's sometimes you're like, fuck, I wish I was a consultant. You know what I mean? Anyway, let's get into the label, because You know, I know some of the things you've been doing. I know that you just did this record release for Ian. And that was at Glenn's place, right? GB's Juke Joint.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And he's got a great streaming rig. It's amazing.
And we've done a few concerts there.
Yeah, man. And so, I mean, what is your game now that, I mean, during COVID, I mean, it had a change. So I'm not going to say has it changed, but like, what are you seeing? I mean, I know that jazz is such a niche market anyway. It's not like, you know, it's like you were selling millions before and now you're, you know, but still, what are you seeing?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I've noticed, so God, what have we been, almost 9 months?
March, April, May, June, July. Oh man, yes, I mean, it's 9 months. It feels like fucking eternity.
It feels like forever.
Yeah.
So yeah, there has, so I mean, to simplify it, what I've seen is an extreme desire by people to support artists and support music. And, you know, the label for me, so there are sort of two facets of the label. There's the Canadian side of the label, and then there's the American side. And the reason why it's important to delineate between the two is that I'm heavily funded by an organization called Factor Canada, which is a foundation to assist Canadian talent on record.
God damn it. Why don't we have something like that?
I could tell you stories that make your head spin. And they have been incredible. At supporting Canadian releases now. The problem with Canadian releases, even though the talent is incredible, it's they only can go so far. Whereas when I do an American release with, whether it be Ian, and Ian's a bad example because he's on TV every single night, so he's kind of a name. But, you know, even somebody like Hazeltine.
Right.
Like if I do a Hazeltine trio record or a Jed Patton trio record or I'm just looking at my spines here, you know, whatever it happens to be, Grant Stewart.
All right.
You know, New York guys, it has some cachet.
Yeah.
New York has a lot of
cachet. And all those guys are great. I mean, you know.
So. Yes. So what's happened is there's been people have supported our website. I remember not so long ago when I would get, I don't know, I would get maybe two orders a week. If I was lucky, maybe one every 2 or 3 weeks. Now it's every single day.
Good.
Every single day I wake up, you know, oh, I got to fulfill that order. I got to fulfill that order, whether it's download, physical. Our physical distributor in the States have had some of their best months that they've had in 10, 15 years. So Great. We still move a lot of physical product. We move a lot of digital product. We've got this archival label that I started that's kind of taken off a little bit. None of it is enough to say, hey, I can pay myself $5,000 a month and pay my mortgage. But it's enough to be generating more stuff. It's enough to keep me busy. It's enough to kind of bide some time and I can take a little bit of money out of it and pay myself and do okay and still do what I love to do. So we're still putting out records. We're doing live streams. You know, I think a big part of this whole COVID thing is how do we all stay relevant? You know, and I didn't like that. Somebody said that, what are you doing? Like, you got to stay relevant. And I'm like, no, I don't. I don't have to stay. Why do I have to stay relevant? And then I realized, you do. You need to stay out there. And there's a cost to doing that. And if I can do it in a way that I don't spend a whole bunch of money, great. So the live streams, they don't make any money, but it keeps me out there.
I know. It is important.
It keeps Glenn, you know, it keeps Glenn working.
I know.
It was a gig for Ian. It was some exposure for me. It's like it really is like this community thing, you know. And so that's what I try to concentrate on and just say, like, we are kind of, I'm not a big we're all in this together kind of guy. Like, when it comes right down to it, it's every man for himself. And I think sometimes we like to hide that under, like, oh no, we're all in this, you know, we're all in this together. But I have a group of people and a group of friends who I love and who I care about, and whether it's Spike and Paul Stash, and I mean, you know, you and I don't know each other as well as I know those guys, but like these people that really care about the music, like those are the people that we're in it together with. And Glenn is a great guy and he's been awesome to work with. He provides us a great product. He's not making any money when I pay him. I'm not making any money by doing this. You know, by the time Ian gets out there, you know, he's not making any money. So nobody's really making any money, but it's about doing this thing together. And the interesting part about it is, and I wish I could, I've been looking for it ever since I saw it and I could never find it, but we're all on this same playing field. Like COVID just wiped us all out, and we're all starting here. You know, there's no hierarchy right now. Like I'm getting as many
games. There's no caste system at all.
You know, yeah. It's just like there's no, you know, it's like, oh, that guy gets all the gigs. Like, no, I'm actually gigging way more than him, you know? So it's interesting, but there has been a real change, a real emphasis for people to help and to support. You know, we started a fundraising campaign just kind of for fun because people were saying, well, how can we help? Like, what can we do? And I've never really had an outlet for that. So, you know, I just sort of keep planning and keep doing stuff and try to be frugal about it and say, we're going to get through this. Even though some days I'm like, are we actually going to get through this? Like, how is this going to look on the other side?
I mean, it's hard, dude. I mean, you know? The Jazz Standard just closed. I never thought that was going to happen. And that's heartbreaking. Crazy. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's difficult. I mean, the one thing that you have going is that, like you said, jazz isn't something that makes millions of dollars typically. So it's not, you don't have as far to fall.
Yes, yeah, for sure, though. It's true. It's funny, but it's true. Like,
and I mean, I say that to all my friends and the truth with me as well. And also, you can do a lot of things from your home, yeah. You know, which is lucky. You don't have it's hard. You know, Glenn, one of my, you know, very, very dear friends, I'm kind of the one that introduced him to everyone. I've known him for a lot of years, and he has so much gear that you know, and that's why he can make these great live streams. But that's the kind of thing where you have a lot of overhead, and especially because he does so much live sound work, like those gigs aren't happening right now. So no. You know, it's good that, you know, he's getting all this live streaming stuff, because it might be a minute before we get out of this. And I mean, might be, it will be. And yeah, I mean, I think that you're right about the relevance thing. I think that you have to stay in the public eye. I don't know if relevant is the right word, but you have to stay out there, because when you see things like the Standard close, or, you know, all these news stories that pop up about so-and-so, you know, going bankrupt, or, yeah. You know, I mean, it's important to show people that you're still here and you're still making music and you're doing it because you love it. And, you know, we're the same way. Like my company, we give the majority of our proceeds to the artists. You know what I mean? And when I pay people, it's like a fucking hallelujah moment. Like people, everyone on our roster just thanks me. And they're like, thank you. Because you know what? I didn't get shit from Spotify. I didn't get shit from like streaming. Like it's difficult. And thanks, you know what I mean? Like you're paying us, and it makes me feel good and absolutely sad at the same time, you know what I mean?
It's weird. I mean, I have a friend in Seattle, his name's Matt Jorgensen, great drummer, and he has a company called Origin Records. Mm-hmm. And he could very early in COVID, so when COVID hit, we coincided with spring break, and actually when COVID hit, I was one day away from flying to New York with my tour group,
right?
Anyway, that's a whole other story. But anyways, we stayed home. So I was on spring break. I was like, man, I'm just going to chill. We got some booze. We're staying home with the kids and we're just going to listen to records and play games. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
And then Matt called me and said, what are you doing? Like, you should do like a Facebook. And I had watched all these people do these Facebook Live things. And I thought they were really kind of haphazard. I'm like, I'm not going to do that. And it was Matt who called me up and said, you got to do something. I'm like, why? He's like, because it doesn't matter how big your community is. You're the leader. Like you're a leader in your community and they need to and want to hear from you. And he almost made it like it was, and he did it in a way a friend would do it. He was like, it's kind of your responsibility as a leader in your community to stand up and be heard from.
Yeah.
So I was like, I never actually thought of it like that. So I started doing a Tales of a Club Owner series. I called it from where I'm sitting right now. And I would just tell stories about owning the club and take questions. And it was really good. I got like 50 or 60 people kind of tuning in. And it was sort of an unscripted thing. And so it kind of lost legs at the end because I had no idea what I'd talked about the previous 3 or 4 weeks. So I just kind of stopped. But then we got into the concerts. And you got some funding. The government came up with a lot of money. You apply for grants. And so we did some stuff. We're very lucky here in Canada, especially when you're in the
I'm getting pissed off with all this this government help talk. If my government isn't doing shit for me.
if you knew the funding we got from Factor for these records, sometimes when something's too good to be true, like it is, but this is just, I've been in the program for 3 years now. I have a really good friend who used to be very high up and used to work for Verve, and he was a guy, and he got out of the business completely, but he does all my grant writing. And he called me up one day and said, you're going to have to pay me. So I'm going to charge you $2,000. And if you get the grant, you got to pay me. If you don't get it, it's $1,000. So at that time I was like, well, whatever, I'll take the $1,000 risk. And he got me into the program. So we've been into the program now for 3 years.
Yeah. And you've gotten a lot more than $1,000 back, I'm sure.
Yeah, oh man, it's insane. And then when COVID hit, they also anteed up for labels, you know, as well. So I feel very lucky. It's not gonna last forever.
No, but it's beautiful. And
it got us through. So it's allowed me to stay somewhat positive around, you know, what I'm doing and you know, continuing to try to push it forward and move forward.
You know? Yeah. So. And, you know, and as far as the U.S. is concerned, I mean, they have to, and this is, you know, I know how many listeners we have. We do pretty well, but I don't know if any of them are politicians. Who knows? Regardless, if I could talk to any of these people, I'd say, you know, you got to think about the arts. Do you really want a country that has no music clubs anymore? You know what I mean? Like, that is just a bit like New York City is where I spent the majority of my life. And right now we're a little outside of New York City. We're like 30 minutes out in Westchester, you know? So we have a house because I have a small child who runs amok. But New York is about the arts. It's about,
sure it is.
It's about everything. I mean, you know, there's Broadway, there's acting, there's music, there's dance, there's everything. And it's just like, without these little artistic spots, it's hard, man. And you know, the rents are ridiculous. I know Vancouver is crazy too, so I'm
pretty sure. Yes, it is.
Vancouver is actually one of the few that's as bad or worse, like San Francisco, you know.
Yeah, it's really bad.
Yeah, but that being said, really, it's like, man, you know, we need to protect our arts, or else it's going to be like just a soulless corporate shitty city. Yeah. You know, I mean, and a country, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the good news is that jazz kind of, like, it, I think it was Spike that coined this. I wish I could remember. It's like a weed, you know, that finds the cracks, you know.
And it's resilient,
and, you know, it's really I mean, you know, with all due respect to like the jazz standard and there's been a few other things, it's going to be interesting, because I always say anybody can survive 1 to 6 months.
Correct.
But it's six months to a year where stuff starts to get funky. And I know, you know, when you start seeing things, this is completely non-music related, but right close to where I live is this huge sports fitness center called 40th Sports. And they're done. Over. Just finished.
I mean, the rent must have been astronomical. Like,
when you see things of that size falling that are funded by very rich people.
Totally.
It's like, man. But I look around and I question myself, like, how am I still able to put out this stupid little record and have it, like, do okay?
Because you're smaller, man.
It's weird. It's just,
I think it helps. Yeah.
Helps. Because, I mean, it's insane.
Yeah. Like, when you're these massive corporations, you know, they just can't survive. There's a board, and if the board decides that they're losing too much money, they just cut
it. Yeah, they're just done. They cut it out. Yeah. So yeah, it's crazy, you know. But I think it's going to get a little worse before it gets better. But it seems like we're on the other side. I mean, we can kind of see it in the distant future. I still don't know if we know how it's going to look, but I think it's going to be over. But a lot of people are going to die first, which is sad. And you know, a lot of bad shit's going to happen, but I can see it, and we can sort of see it, and then it's like, okay, well, it's you know, what's going
to
happen?
Yeah, I mean, to end it on a positive note, because we've talked about a lot, like, and this isn't just me trying to say something positive, because we're talking about dark shit. The truth is that a lot of great music has come out of really, really bad times.
Sure.
The Renaissance period, the rebirth. Like, there's literally a period of music named after this, right? So, I mean, there's been wars and tragedy, and art always perseveres, and it comes back stronger, and maybe it'll even change in a good way and add some kind of emotional element that'll touch people. And I do believe that. I do believe it's going to be super hard, but it's up to us to keep going as long as we can and fighting the fight until hopefully, until this is sorted out and all the musicians listening, keep practicing and keep working on things and getting ready for the reopening of the world, and keep learning more stuff, learn Pro Tools or Logic or whatever. Just keep adding to your skill sets. Learn about...
That's a big one.
Yeah, learn about promotion. Learn about all these things that you didn't have time to do before because you're gigging so much. I mean, this is the time. We talk about a lot of that stuff on the podcast, but, the glass is kind of half full. I mean, it's hard to see it that way, but I do believe that we can come out of this stronger if we don't kill each other,
Yeah, the key is staying sane. I think a few things that I think what my prediction is that a few things are going to happen. One thing that's going to happen is there's going to be an appetite for live music like there never has been. Now,
which is
awesome. I should preface this all by saying I don't know how long it's going to last, but initially there's going to be an appetite for live music like it's never that's never been before. Venues. And not that venues are bad, venues are awesome, we need venues, but this venue versus musician kind of mentality that exists, I was talking to Ken Fowler about this the other day, the only reason there are people in the Roxy Lounge drinking and now nobody's there because Cuomo shut it down, but last week and the last month is because there's music there. Otherwise, it's the same at Frankie's. They would be... Without the jazz, it would be empty.
Right.
So I think there's an appreciation for the music from the fans. There's an appreciation for the music from the venues and the presenters. And I hope, I think what will hopefully happen as well, and I don't think it's going to be a massive difference, but I think we might just, if we get lucky, be able to value ourselves and our services a little higher.
Yeah, man.
After this, and if those three things come out of this, it's not all bad with respect to people that have lost their lives and lost their businesses. These are some things that can happen that are good, out of this.
No, I 100% agree with you, man. And I think that's a good way to end this on a positive note. Man, thanks so much it's been too long, right? I mean,
we should do it more, man.
2003 or 4 or something with Ian. And but anyway, man, it was great hanging, and enjoy your night. And hopefully we'll see each other sooner than later.
Yeah, anytime, man. Love talking about all this stuff. So anytime you want to chat, stay well. And yeah, hopefully when all this ends, I'll be back in New York a lot, so we'll hook up.
All right, man. Later.
Thanks, Adam. Ciao.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail, you can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.